Chapter 6. The matter of that important discussion was a comparison of notes regarding a problem that Vaughn was to try to resolve in another way, many years later. Several cases of acrophobia had been closely examined at the Kingston Clinic to determine if they were combined with any traces or aspects of time terror. Tests had yielded completely negative results, but what seemed particularly curious was that the only available case of acute chronophobia differed by its very nature, metaphysical flavor, psychological stamp, and so forth, from that of space fear. True, one patient maddened by the touch of time's texture presented too small a sample to compete with a great group of garrulous acrophobes and readers who have been accusing Vaughn of rashness and folly. In young Ratner's polite terminology, will have a higher opinion of him when they learn that our young investigator did his best not to let Mr. T.T., the chronophobe, be cured too hastily of his rare and important sickness. Vaughn had satisfied himself that it had nothing to do with clocks or calendars or any measurements or contents of time, while he suspected and hoped, as only a discoverer, pure and passionate and profoundly inhuman, can hope, that the dread of heights would be found by his colleagues to depend mainly on the misestimation of distances, and that Mr. Arshin, their best acrophobe, who cannot step down from a footstool, could be made to step down into space from the top of a tower if persuaded by some optical trick that the fire net spread 50 yards below was a mat 1 inch beneath him. Vaughn had cold cuts brought up for them and a gallon of gallows ale, but his mind was elsewhere, and he did not shine in the discussion which forever remained in his mind as a grisaille of inconclusive tedium. They left around midnight. Their clatter and chatter still came from the stairs when he began ringing up Ardis Hall. Vainly. Vainly. He kept it up intermittently till daybreak, gave up, had a structurally perfect stool, its cruciform symmetry reminding him of the morning before his duel, and, without bothering to put on a tie, all his favorite ones were awaiting him in his new apartment, drove to Manhattan, taking the wheel when he found that Edmund had needed 45 minutes instead of half an hour to cover 1/4 of the way. All he had wanted to say to Ada over the dumb Dorophone amounted to 3 words in English, contractible to 2 in Russian, to 1.5 in Italian. But Ada was to maintain that his frantic attempts to reach her at Ardis had only resulted in such a violent rhapsody of Egra that finally the basement boiler gave up and there was no hot water. No water at all, in fact, when she got out of bed. So she pulled on her warmest coat and had Bouteillon, discreetly rejoicing old Bouteillon, carry her valises down and drive her to the airport. In the meantime, Vaughn had arrived at Alexis Avenue, had lain in bed for an hour, then shaved and showered and almost torn off with the brutality of his pounce the handle of the door leading to the terrace as there came the sound of a celestial motor. Despite an athletic strength of will, ironization of excessive emotion, and contempt for weepy weaklings, Vaughn was aware of his being apt to suffer incurable blubbering fits, rising at times to an epileptic-like pitch with sudden howls that shook his body and inexhaustible fluids that stuffed his nose. Ever since his break with Ada had led to agonies which his self-pride and self-concentration had never foreseen in the hedonistic past. A small monoplane, chartered if one judged by its nacreous wings and illegal but abortive attempts to settle on the central green oval of the park, after which it melted in the morning mist to seek a perch elsewhere, wrenched a first sob from Vaughn as he stood in his short terry on the roof terrace, now embellished by shrubs of blue spirea in invincible bloom. He stood in the chill sun until he felt his skin under the robe turn to an armadillo's pelvic plates. Cursing and shaking both fists at breast level, he returned into the warmth of his flat and drank a bottle of champagne, and then rang for Rose, the sportive Negro maid, whom he shared in more ways than one with the famous, recently decorated cryptogrammatist Mr. Dean, a perfect gentleman, dwelling on the floor below. With jumbled feelings, with unpardonable lust, Vaughn watched her pretty behind roll and tighten under its lacy bow as she made the bed, while her lower lover could be heard through the radiator pipes humming to himself happily. He had decoded again a Tartar dorogram telling the Chinese where we planned to land next time. Rose soon finished putting the room in order and flirted off, and the Pandian hum had hardly had time to be replaced, rather artlessly for a person of Dean's profession, by a crescendo of international creaks that a child could decipher, when the hallway bell dingled, and next moment, whiter-faced, redder-mouthed, four-year-older Ada stood before a convulsed, already sobbing, ever-adolescent Vaughn, her flowing hair blending with dark furs that were even richer than her sister's. He had prepared one of those phrases that sound right in dreams but lame in lucid life. "I saw you circling above me on Libellula wings." He broke down on Ula and fell at her feet, at her bare insteps in glossy black glass slippers, precisely in the same attitude, the same heap of hopeless tenderness, self-immolation, denunciation of demoniac life in which he would drop in back thought in the innermost bower of his brain every time he remembered her impossible semi-smile as she adjusted her shoulder blades to the trunk of the final tree. An invisible stagehand now slipped a seat under her, and she wept and stroked his black curls as he went through his fit of grief, gratitude, and regret. It might have persisted much longer had not another physical frenzy that had been stirring his blood since the previous day offered a blessed distraction. As if she had just escaped from a burning palace and a perishing kingdom, she wore over her rumpled nightdress a deep brown, hoar-glossed coat of sea otter fur, the famous Kamchatskye bobber of ancient Estotian traders, also known as Lutromarina, on the Lacascan coast. "My natural fur," as Marina used to say pleasantly of her own cape, inherited from a Zemsky granddam, when, at the dispersal of a winter ball, some lady wearing vizen or koipu or a lowly manteau de castor, beaver, Nemetsky bober, would comment with a rapturous moan on the Boborova shuba, "Staryenkaya, old little thing," Marina used to add in fond deprecation, the usual counterpart of the Bostonian lady's coy thank you, ventriloquizing her banal mink or nutria in response to polite praise, which did not prevent her from denouncing afterwards the swank of that stuck-up actress who actually was the least ostentatious of souls. Ada's bobri, princely plural of bober, were a gift from Dimon, who, as we know, had lately seen in the western states considerably more of her than he had in eastern Estotiland when she was a child. The bizarre enthusiast had developed the same tendresse for her as he had always had for Vaughn. Its new expression in regard to Ada looked sufficiently fervid to make watchful fools suspect that old Dimon slept with his niece. Actually, he was getting more and more occupied with Spanish girls who were getting more and more youthful every year, until by the end of the century, when he was 60, with hair dyed a midnight blue, his flame had become a difficult nymphette of 10. So little did the world realize the real state of affairs that even Cordula Tobac, born Dupre, and Grace Wellington, born Erminen, spoke of Dimond Veen with his fashionable goatee and frilled shirt front as Vaughn's successor. Neither sibling ever could reconstruct, and all this, including the sea otter, must not be regarded as a narrator's evasion. We have done, in our time, much more difficult things. What they said, how they kissed, how they mastered their tears, how he swept her couchward, gallantly proud to manifest his immediate reaction to her being as scantily gowned under her hot furs as she had been when carrying her candle through that magic picture window. After feasting fiercely on her throat and nipples, he was about to proceed to the next stage of demented impatience, but she stopped him, explaining that she must first of all take her morning bath. This indeed was a new Ada, and that, moreover, she expected her luggage would be brought up any moment now by the louts of the Monaco lounge. She had taken the wrong entrance, yet Vaughn had bribed Cordula's devoted janitor to practically carry Ada upstairs. "Quick, quick," said Ada. "Da, da, Ada'll be out of the foam in 2 secs." But mad, obstinate Vaughn shed his terry and followed her into the bathroom, where she strained across the low tub to turn on both taps, and then bent over to insert the bronze-chained plug. It got sucked in by itself, however, while he steadied her lovely lyre, and next moment was at the suede soft root, was gripped, was deep between the familiar, incomparable crimson-lined lips. She caught at the twin cock crosses, thus involuntarily increasing the sympathetic volume of the water's noise, and Vaughn emitted a long groan of deliverance. And now their four eyes were looking again into the azure brook of Pinedale, and Lucette pushed the door open with a perfunctory knuckle knock and stopped, mesmerized by the sight of Vaughn's hairy rear and the dreadful scar all along his left side. Ada's hands stopped the water. Luggage was being bumped down all over the flat. "I'm not looking," said Lucette idiotically. "I only dropped in for my box."
"Please, tip them, pet," said Vaughn, a compulsive tipper.
"And pass me that towel," added Ada. But the Ancilla was picking up coins she had spilled in her haste, and Ada now saw, in her turn, Vaughn's scarlet ladder of sutures.
"Oh, my poor darling," she cried, and out of sheer compassion allowed him the repeat performance which Lucette's entrance had threatened to interrupt.
"I'm not sure I did bring her damned Cranach crayons," said Ada a moment later, making a frightened frog face.
He watched her with a sense of perfect pine-fragrant bliss as she squeezed out spurts of gem-like liquid from a tube of Pencilvestris lotion into the bathwater. Lucette had gone, leaving a curt note with her room number at the Winster Hotel for young ladies, when our two lovers, now weak-legged and decently robed, sat down to a beautiful breakfast. Ardis's crisp bacon, Ardis's translucent honey, brought up in the lift by Valerio, a ginger-haired elderly Roman, always ill-shaven and gloomy, but a dear old boy. He it was who, having procured Neat Rose last June, was being paid to keep her strictly for Veen and Dean. What laughs, what tears, what sticky kisses, what a tumult of multitudinous plans, and what safety, what freedom of love. Two unrelated gypsy courtesans, a wild girl in a gaudy Lolita, poppy-mouthed and black-downed, picked up in a café between Grasse and Nice, and another, a part-time model. You have seen her fondling a virile lipstick in Falata ads, aptly nicknamed Swallowtail by the patrons of Norfolk Broad's Floramore, had both given our hero exactly the same reason, unmentionable in a family chronicle, for considering him absolutely sterile, despite his prowess. Amused by the Hecatean diagnose, Vaughn underwent certain tests, and although poo-pooing the symptom as coincidental, all the doctors agreed that Vaughn Veen might be a doughty and durable lover, but could never hope for an offspring. How merrily little Ada clapped her hands. Would she like to stay in this apartment till spring term? He thought in terms of terms now, and then accompany him to Kingston? Or would she prefer to go abroad for a couple of months, anywhere, Patagonia, Angola, Gululu in the New Zealand mountains, stay in this apartment? So, she liked it? Except some of Cordula's stuff which should be ejected, as for example that conspicuous Brown Hill alma mater, or Almus left open on poor Vanda's portrait. She had been shot dead by the girlfriend of a girlfriend on a starry night in Ragusa, of all places. It was, Vaughn said, sad. Little Lucette, no doubt, had told him about a later escapade,
punning in an Ophelian frenzy on the feminine glands, raving about the delectations of clitorism.
N'exagérons pas, tu sais, said Ada, patting the air down with both palms.
Lucette affirmed, he said, that she, Ada, imitated mountain lions.
He was omniscient. Better say, omni-incest.
That's right, said the other total recaller.
And, by the way, Grace. Yes, Grace was Vanda's real favorite. Pas petit moi and my little crest. She, Ada, hadn't she? A way of always smoothing out the folds of the past, making the flautist practically impotent, except with his wife, and allowing the gentleman farmer only one embrace, with a premature eyakulyatsiya, one of those hideous Russian loanwords. Yes, wasn't it hideous? But she'd love to play Scrabble again when they'd settled down for good.
But where?
How? Wouldn't Mr. and Mrs. Ivan Veen do quite nicely anywhere? What about the single in each passport? They'd go to the nearest consulate and with roars of indignation and or a fabulous bribe have it corrected to married forever and ever.
I'm a good, good girl. Here are her special pencils. It was very considerate and altogether charming of you to invite her next weekend. I think she's even more madly in love with you than with me, the poor pet.
Demand got them in Strasbourg. After all, she's a demi-vierge now. I hear you and Dad, began Vaughn. But the introduction of a new subject was swamped, and we shan't be afraid of her witnessing our Eba, pronouncing on purpose, with triumphant hooliganism, for which my prose too is praised, the first vowel, a la Russe.
You do the puma, he said. But she does, to perfection, my favorite viola sordina. She's a wonderful imitatrix, by the way. And if you are even better...
We'll speak about my talents and tricks some other time, said Ada. It's a painful subject. Now, let's look at these snapshots.